Beacon Press Audio presents They Just Need to Get a Job, 15 Myths on Homelessness by Mary Brosnahan. This audiobook is narrated by Kristen Kalin Keck. Published by Beacon Press Audio 2024. Preface: The Function of Myth. The original purpose of myth was to explain the inexplicable, to offer answers to life's most profound questions, from how do we come into existence to why do we die. They provided powerful narratives around our most evocative feelings, fears, and desires. Their stories transmitted common values and aspirational arcs across generations through millennia. They endure because they convey fundamental truths about the human condition. They get inside people and compel them to action. Joseph Campbell, beyond his influential writings on the earliest metaphysical and cosmological realms of myth, underscored the modern-day sociological purpose of myth: to pass down ethical codes and shared values that dictate prevailing social structure. In short, myths reveal who gives the orders and why. While Homer created epics through which he sought to convey truth, the advent of scientific reasoning 400 years later rendered the term myth a synonym for fictional tales of superstition or fantasy, symbolic stories without proof. This book addresses common myths about homelessness on both levels, cultural narrative and fictional tale. It dismantles the wall of lies and half-truths that has been built up over the past half century, a wall that has distanced us emotionally from the suffering of our homeless neighbors and has dammed away any promise of investments in lasting solutions. The first section provides a historical overview of housing instability, starting with the enclosure of the British Commons, through the Industrial Age, and the waves of emigration to what would become the United States. The contours of each of these eras was shaped enormously by English poor laws, which were molded by Calvinistic axioms of worthy versus unworthy paupers. This false dichotomy remains the most destructive, yet enduring and influential of narratives. From there, we examine the history of homelessness in the U.S., including the foundational myths of our nation, encoded in the creation of our Constitution, and the more recent deregulation of our capitalistic system. We also look closely at specific groups of people without homes: homeless youth, our neighbors struggling with severe and persistent mental illness, those living in emergency shelter, and our neighbors living rough on our streets and in other public spaces. We also unpack the policies that function to systematically dehumanize Americans without housing, often with the expressed intent to destroy them by erasure. Each of these individual myths falls squarely in the modern definition of myth as lie or falsehood. But collectively, they also fulfill the ancient purpose of myth: to explain, or in this case, more precisely, justify, the unexplainable. How can we allow hundreds of thousands of Americans to live and die on our streets? These myths, as a whole, serve to shift responsibility away from the systemic causes of homelessness and onto homeless people themselves. When we tell each other these myths, the intended result is to deaden us to our neighbor's plight and obscure the structural violence they endure, perhaps the most grotesque repercussion of unregulated late-stage global capitalism. The ultimate goal of leveling these destructive myths is to give us the space that is essential to constructing a truthful counter-narrative, one based in facts and that bolsters significant investment in proven housing-based solutions. Although some of the details herein are centered in New York, owing to my decades of work in New York City and state, this book and its recommendations are national in scope, as meaningful reform is needed urgently at every level of government. Introduction. Anita. Throughout the mid-1990s, New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani unleashed a series of police raids to sweep homeless encampments off the streets. In the wake of one of those blitzes, I spent a freezing February morning driving around the East Bronx with my colleague Michael Pullenberg, looking for and speaking with the men who had been rousted and scattered by the New York Police Department. What neighborhoods had they been purged from? Where were they sleeping now? Were they able to find food and places to stay warm? We gave out blankets, coats, woolen socks, and subway tokens. We also gave directions to the Coalition for the Homeless office on Chambers Street, as most of the men had lost essential items in the raids: birth certificates, welfare cards, steel-toed work boots, personal photos, and correspondence. And our crisis intervention team wanted to help in any way possible. Whenever we asked if they had slept recently in NYC's vast emergency shelter system, most said that they'd been robbed, harassed, or physically assaulted there, often by shelter security or staff. And to a man, everyone seeking shelter had been forced to go to intake at Bellevue Men's Shelter on East 30th Street and wait until after midnight to be transported to Ward's Island, a no man's land in the East River. Once there, they were given a bed at 2 or 3 a.m., only to be awoken a few hours later at 7 a.m. and told to take a bus and subway back to intake, to repeat the intentionally cruel process for days, sometimes weeks on end. Active deterrence was the city's guiding principle. Make it as hard as humanly possible to get a stable shelter placement while simultaneously directing frontline police to break up groups of more than three people bedding down together on the streets and other public spaces. Soon after we returned to Chambers Street that afternoon, Michael poked his head in my office door. "Hey, I don't know how to say this," as his voice trailed off. "I have a woman in my office and I really don't have any idea what to do." Michael had worked for years at the Coalition and had seen it all, so I was surprised to see him so rattled. "I think she might be mentally ill. I can't understand anything she's saying, and she's got a tiny baby with her." Michael and I walked back to his small cubicle, where he split his time between advocacy and crisis work. There, sitting in a folding chair, hunched over her baby, was a large black woman, looking listless and exhausted, rocking back and forth. Michael handed me her intake form. Her name was Anita. "Hi, I'm Mary," I said, extending my hand. She glanced up and slowly lifted up her hand. No grip, but a swell of tears. I sat down next to her so that I could look more closely at the baby. He was tightly swaddled and as perfectly clad as any three-week-old can be. "Anita," I asked, "where are you from?" She stared back blankly. "Where did you two sleep last night?" "Staten Island," Anita answered. That set off a deluge of jagged sobs. Her crying set the baby off, too. I can't remember what I said next, probably the usual reassurance that whatever was going on, we were going to help make it right. We had a modest food pantry along with clothes and diapers on hand. But what I do remember is this: how fucking hot it was in that cubicle. Our offices were in a crumbling loft building in Lower Manhattan. The windows were single-paned, so thin the wind would blow papers off the windowsill. But the interior cubicles were stifling on even the coldest days as heat poured out unregulated from ancient radiators. The child, swaddled as he was sweating. A light green crocheted cap tightly crowned his red face. "Your baby seems a bit hot," I offered. "Yes," Anita replied and unwrapped the blanket. Beneath, his clothes were clean and he looked well-fed. But equally important, Anita and I were communicating. Freed from the blanket, the baby's wail came down a notch from full throttle, but he was still obviously uncomfortable. I instinctively reached over for his cap. "Maybe let's take this hat off." As I gently pulled it off, Anita went into near hysterics, and with the hat off, I saw why. The baby's hair was terribly matted, twisted in small clumps around his scalp. "You see? You see? My baby's hair, it's so tangled. I can't even get a comb to unknot it. It's so matted," she sobbed as she ran her hand over the snarled clusters. Michael had slipped out and gotten a glass of water, and I passed it to Anita. I rubbed her back and tried to assure her it was okay. Everything was going to be okay. Each of us...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?